Chapter 19. After 12 hours at Sarah's hospital bedside, Dirk finally convinced the doctors at Seattle's Swedish Providence Medical Center to release Sarah the following morning. Though a broken leg didn't normally warrant an overnight stay, the cautious medical staff was concerned about trauma from the accident and kept her there for observation. She was fortunate in that the break to her tibia, or shin bone, did not require any rods or screws to align. The doctors wrapped her leg in a heavy plaster cast and pumped her full of painkillers, then signed her release. "Guess I can't take you dancing anytime soon," Dirk joked as he pushed her out the hospital exit in a wheelchair. "Not unless you want a black and blue foot," she replied, grimacing at the heavy cast around her lower leg. Despite insisting that she was well enough to work, Dirk took Sarah home to her stylish apartment in Seattle's Capitol Hill district. Gently carrying her to a leather couch, he propped her broken leg up on a large pillow. "Afraid I've been called back to Washington," he said, stroking her silky hair as she adjusted the pillows behind her back. "Have to leave tonight. I'll make sure Sandy checks in on you." "I probably won't be able to keep her away," she grinned. "But what about the sick crew members of the Deep Endeavor? We need to find out if they're all right," she said, struggling to rise from the couch. The drugs made her feel as if her mind and body were enshrouded in a coat of honey, and she fought to remain lucid against the overwhelming desire to sleep. "Okay," he said, gently pushing her back down and bringing a portable phone to her. "You get one phone call, then it's lights out for you." As she called the public health lab, he checked to see that her kitchen was stocked with groceries. Peering into a scantily filled refrigerator, he idly wondered why unmarried women always seemed to have less food in the house than the single men he knew. "Great news," she called in a slurred voice after hanging up the phone. "The tests on the sick crewmen all came back negative. No sign of the smallpox virus." "That is great news," Dirk said, returning to her side. "I'll let Captain Birch know before I leave for the airport."
"When will I see you again?"
she asked, squeezing his hand. "Just a quick trip to headquarters. I'll be back before you know it."
"You better,"
she replied, her eyelids drooping low. Dirk leaned over and brushed her hair aside, then kissed her gently on the forehead. As he stood up, he could see that she had already fallen asleep. Dirk slept soundly on his cross-country red-eye flight, popping awake well-rested as the wheels of the Pneuma jet touched down at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport just after 8 in the morning. An agency car was left waiting for him at the government terminal, and he drove himself out of the parking lot under a light drizzle. As he exited the airport, he cast a long glance towards a dilapidated-looking hangar situated off one of the runways. Though his father was out of the country, he still had the urge to visit the old man's hideout and tinker with one of his many antique autos stored there. Business before pleasure, he told himself, and wheeled the loaner car onto the highway. Following the George Washington Memorial Parkway out of the airport, he drove north, passing the Pentagon on his left as he followed the banks of the Potomac River. A short distance later, he turned off the highway and angled towards a towering green glass building which housed the Pneuma headquarters. Passing through an employee security gate, he pulled into an underground garage and parked. Opening the car trunk, he hoisted a large duffel bag over his shoulder, then rode the employee's elevator to the 10th floor, where the doors opened onto an elaborate maze of quietly humming computer hardware. Established with a budget that would make a third-world dictator whimper, the Pneuma Ocean Data Center computer network was a marvel of state-of-the-art computer processing. Buried within its massive data storage banks was the finest collection of oceanographic resources in the world. Real-time inputs of weather, current, temperature, and biodiversity measurements were collected via satellite from hundreds of remote sea sites from around the world, giving a global snapshot of ocean conditions and trends at any given moment. Links to the leading research universities provided data on current investigations in geology, marine biology, and undersea flora and fauna research, as well as engineering and technology. Pneuma's own historical reference library contained literally millions of data sources and was a constant reservoir of information for research institutes the world over. Dirk found the maestro behind the vast computer network sitting behind a horseshoe console, munching a bear claw with one hand while tapping a keyboard with the other. To a stranger, Hiram Yeager resembled a groupie from a Bob Dylan concert. His lean body was clad in faded Levi's and matching jean jacket over a white t-shirt, complemented by a pair of scuffed cowboy boots on his feet. With his long gray hair tied in a ponytail, his appearance belied the fact that he lived in a high-end Maryland suburb with an ex-model wife and drove a 7 Series BMW. He caught sight of Dirk over a pair of granny glasses and smiled in greeting.
"Well, the young Mr. Pitt," he grinned warmly.
"Hiram, how are you?"
"Not having smashed my car nor destroyed an agency helicopter, I'd have to say I'm doing quite well," he joked. "By the way, has our esteemed director been advised of the loss of one of Numa's flying assets?"
"Yes." Fortunately, with Dad and Al still over in the Philippines, the bite was tempered somewhat.
"They've had their hands full with a toxic spill they ran across near Mindanao, so your timing was good," Yeager said. "So tell me, to what do I owe the pleasure of your visit?"
"Well," Dirk hesitated, "it's your daughters. I would like to go out with them." The color drained from Yeager's thin, boyish face for a moment as he took Dirk's proposal seriously. Yeager's twin daughters, finishing their last year of private high school, were his pride and joy. For 17 years, he had successfully scared away any male suitors that had the remotest inkling of touching his girls. God forbid the giddiness they'd show over the rugged and charismatic Dirk. "You so much as mentioned their names around me, and I'll have you off the payroll with a ruined credit rating that will take 5 lifetimes to fix," Yeager threatened. It was Dirk's turn to laugh, chuckling loudly at Yeager's vulnerable soft spot. The computer genius softened and grinned as well at Dirk's idle ploy. "Okay, the girls are off limits. But what I really want is a little time with you and Max before my meeting with Rudy later this morning."
"Now that I can approve," Yeager replied with a firm nod of the head.
The bear claw now demolished, he applied both hands and a finger dance over the keyboard to conjure up his bionic confidant, Max. No fellow computer programmer, Max was an artificial intelligence system with a virtual interface in the form of a holographic image. The brainchild of Yeager to aid in researching voluminous databases, he had cleverly modeled the visual interface after his wife, Elsie, adding a sensual voice and saucy personality. On a platform opposite the horseshoe console, an attractive woman with auburn hair and topaz eyes suddenly appeared. She was dressed in a skimpy halter top that revealed her navel and a very short leather skirt.
"Good morning, gentlemen," the three-dimensional image murmured.
"Hi, Max. You remember the younger Dirk Pitt?"
"Of course. Nice to see you again, Dirk."
"You're looking good, Max."
"I'd look better if Hiram would stop dressing me in Britney Spears outfits," she replied with disdain, rolling her hands down her body.
"All right. Tomorrow it will be Prada," Yeager promised.
"Thank you."
"Dirk, what is it that you'd like to ask, Max?" Yeager prompted.
"Max, what can you tell me about Japanese efforts at chemical and biological warfare during World War II?" Dirk asked, turning serious. Max hesitated for a moment as the question generated a massive search through thousands of databases. Not just limiting it to oceanographic resources, Yeager had wired the Numa network into a diverse multitude of government and public information resources, ranging from the Library of Congress to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Sifting through the mass of information, Max consolidated the data points into a concisely summarized reply.
"The Japanese military conducted extensive research and experimentation into chemical and biological weaponry, both during and preceding World War II. Primary research and deployment occurred in Manchuria under the direction of the occupying Japanese Imperial Army after they had seized control of Northeast China in 1931. Numerous facilities were constructed throughout the region as test centers under the guise of lumber mills or other false fronts. Inside the facilities, Chinese captives were subject to a wide variety of human experiments with germ and chemical compounds. The Kikihar facility, under the command of Army Unit 516, was the largest Japanese chemical weapons research and test site, although chemical weapons manufacture actually took place on the Japanese mainland. Changchun, under Army Unit 100, and the sprawling Pingfan facility, under Army Unit 731, were the major biological warfare research and test centers. The facilities were, in fact, large prisons where local criminals and derelicts were sent and used as test subjects, though few of the captives would survive their incarceration.
"I've read about Unit 731," Dirk commented. "Some of their experiments made the Nazis look like Boy Scouts."
Allegations of inhuman experiments performed by the Japanese, particularly in Unit 731, are nearly endless. Chinese prisoners, and even some Allied prisoners of war, were routinely injected with an assortment of deadly pathogens as their captors sought to determine the appropriate lethal dosage. Biological bombs were dropped on prisoners staked to the ground in order to test delivery systems. Many experiments took place outside the walls of the facilities. Typhoid bacilli germs were intentionally released into local village wells, resulting in widespread outbreaks of fever and death. Rats carrying plague-infected fleas were released in congested urban areas as a test of the speed and ferocity of infection. Children were even considered an acceptable target. In one experiment, local village children were given chocolates filled with anthrax, which they gratefully devoured with horrifying side effects.
"That's revolting," Jaeger said, shaking his head. "I hope the perpetrators paid for their crimes."
"For the most part, they did not," Max continued. "Nearly to a man, those in charge of the chemical and biological army units avoided prosecution as war criminals. The Japanese destroyed much of the documentation and the camps themselves before their surrender. American intelligence forces, unaware of the extent of horrors, or in some cases seeking to obtain the results of the ghastly experiments, looked the other way at the atrocities. Many of the Imperial Army medical professionals who worked in the death camps went on to become respected business leaders in Japan's post-war pharmaceutical industry.
"With blood on their hands," Dirk muttered.
"No one knows for sure, but experts estimate that at least 200,000 Chinese died as a result of Japanese chemical and biological warfare activity during the 1930s and 1940s. A large percentage of the casualties were innocent civilians. It was a wartime tragedy that has only recently received much attention from historians and scholars."
"Man's inhumanity to man never ceases to amaze," Jaeger said solemnly. "Max, exactly what pathogens and chemicals did the Japanese work with?" Dirk asked.
"It might be easier to ask which agents they didn't experiment with. Their known research in bacteria and viruses ranged from anthrax, cholera, and bubonic plague to glanders, smallpox, and typhus, with experiments conducted in pretty much everything else in between. Among the chemical agents employed in weaponry were phosgene, hydrogen cyanide, sulfur mustard, and lewisite. It is unknown how much was actually deployed in the field, again due to the fact that the Japanese destroyed most of their records as they retreated from China at the end of the war."
"How would these agents have been used on the battlefield?"
"Chemical agents, possessing a long shelf life, are perfectly suitable for munitions. The Japanese manufactured a large quantity of chemical munitions, mostly in the form of grenades, mortars, and a wide range of artillery shells. Thousands of these weapons were even left behind in Manchuria at the war's end. The Japanese biological delivery systems were less successful due to the sensitive nature of the arming agents. Development of a practical biological artillery shell proved difficult, so much of the Japanese effort at fabricating the release of biological agents was focused on aerial bombs. Known records seem to indicate that the Japanese scientists were never completely satisfied with the effectiveness of the bio-bombs they developed."
Max, are you aware of the use of porcelain as a bomb casing material for these chemical or biological agents?
Why, yes, as a matter of fact. Steel bombs generated excessive heat upon explosion that would destroy the biological pathogens, so the Japanese turned to ceramics. It is known that a variety of porcelain bomb canisters were tested in China as aerial delivery systems for the biological agents.
Dirk felt a lump in his stomach.
The I-403 had indeed been on a mission of death with its biological bombs back in 1945. Fortuitously, the submarine had been sunk, but was that, in fact, the last of its failed mission?
Jaeger broke his concentration.
Max, this is all new history to me. I had no idea the Japanese actually used chemical and biological weapons in battle. Were they ever employed outside of China against American forces?
The Japanese deployment of chemical and biological weapons was primarily restricted to the Chinese theater of war. Limited instances of their usage were also reported in Burma, Thailand, and Malaysia. My data sources show no recorded use of biochemical agents in battle with Western Allied forces, perhaps due to Japanese fear of reprisal. It is suspected that chemical weapons would have been employed in defense of the homeland had an invasion of Japan been necessary.
Of course, your father's discovery proves that chemical munitions were to be stockpiled in the Philippines for possible deployment in defense of the islands.
My father's discovery? I don't understand.
I'm sorry, Dirk. Let me explain. I received a toxin assessment from the Mariana Explorer, taken from an ordnance sample recovered by your father and Al Giordino.
You've completed your database search on the arsenic sample already?
I thought you said you wouldn't have that completed until after lunch, Jaeger asked the hologram.
Sometimes I can just be brutally efficient, she replied, throwing her nose in the air.
What's the connection? Dirk asked, still confused.
Your father and Al traced a toxic arsenic leak to an old cargo ship that apparently sank on a coral reef near Mindanao during World War II.
The arsenic was leaking from a shipment of artillery shells carried in the ship's hold, Jaeger explained.
105-millimeter shells, to be precise, Max added. Ammunition for a common artillery gun used by the Japanese Imperial Army. Only the contents weren't arsenic, per se.
What did you find? Jaeger asked.
The actual contents were a mixture of sulfur mustard and lewisite. A popular chemical munitions concentrate from the 1930s, it acts as a fatal blistering agent when released as a gas. Lewisite is an arsenic derivative, which accounts for the toxic readings found in the Philippines. The Japanese produced thousands of mustard lewisite shells in Manchuria, some of which were deployed against the Chinese. Some of these old buried chemical munitions are still being dug up today.
Was the Japanese Navy connected with the deployment of these weapons? Dirk asked.
The Japanese Imperial Navy was actively involved with chemical weapons production at its Sagami Naval Yard and was believed to have had four additional storage arsenals at Kure, Yokosuka, Hiroshima, and Sasebo. But the Navy possessed only a fraction of the estimated 1.7 million chemical bombs and shells produced during the war, and no records indicate they were ever used in any naval engagements. The biological weapons research was funded through the Imperial Army and, as I mentioned, was centered in occupied China. A primary conduit for the research activity was the Army Medical School in Tokyo. It is unknown whether the Navy had any involvement through the medical school, as the college was destroyed by wartime bombing in 1945.
So no wartime records exist that show chemical or biological weapons were ever assigned on board Navy vessels?
None that were publicly released, Max said, shaking her holographic head. The bulk of the captured Japanese wartime records, including those of the Navy Ministry, were assigned to the National Archives. As a gesture of goodwill, most of the documents were later returned to the Japanese government. Only a fraction of the records were copied, however, and even a smaller portion have ever been translated.
Max, I'd like to explore the Navy Ministry records for information on the mission of a particular Japanese submarine, the I-403. Can you determine whether these records might still exist?
I'm sorry, Dirk, but I don't have access to that portion of the National Archives data records.
Dirk turned to Jaeger with an arched brow and gave him a long, knowing look.
The National Archives, eh? Well, that should be a lot less dangerous than tapping into Langley,
Jaeger acceded with a shrug.
That's the old Silicon Valley hacker I know and love, Dirk replied with a laugh. Give me a couple of hours and I'll see what I can do.
Max, Dirk said, looking at the transparent woman in the eye, thank you for the information.
My pleasure, Dirk, she replied seductively. I'm happy to be at your service any time.
Then, in an instant, she vanished. Jaeger already had his nose against a computer monitor, fingers flying over a keyboard, completely engrossed in his subversive mission at hand. At promptly 10 o'clock, Dirk entered a plush executive conference room, still carrying the large duffel bag over his shoulder. Thick azure carpet under his feet complemented the dark cherrywood conference table and matching wood paneling on the walls, which were dotted with ancient oil paintings of American Revolutionary warships. A thick pane of glass stretched the length of one wall, offering a bird's-eye view of the Potomac River and the Washington Mall across the water. Seated at the table, two stone-faced men in dark suits listened attentively as a diminutive man in horn-rimmed glasses discussed the Deep Endeavor's recent events in the Aleutian Islands. Rudy Gunn stopped in mid-sentence and popped to his feet as Dirk entered the room.
Dirk, good of you to return to Washington so quickly, he greeted warmly, his bright blue eyes beaming through the thick pair of eyeglasses. Glad to see your ferry landing injuries were minor, he added, eyeing Dirk's swollen lip and bandaged cheek. My companion broke her leg, but I managed to escape with just a fat lip. We fared a little better than the other guys, he said with a smirk, whoever they were. It's good to see you again, Rudy, he added, shaking the hand of Numa's longtime assistant director.
Gunn escorted him over and introduced him to the other two men.
Dirk, this is Jim Webster, Department of Homeland Security Special Assistant, Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection, he said, waving a hand towards a pale-skinned man with cropped blonde hair. And Rob Yost, Assistant Director of Maritime and Land Security, Transportation Security Administration under DHS.
A rotund, bearish-looking man with a flush red nose nodded at Dirk without smiling.
We were discussing Captain Birch's report of your rescue of the CDC team on Yanaska Island, Gunn continued.
A fortunate thing we happened to be in the area. I'm just sorry we weren't able to reach the two Coast Guardsmen in time. Given the apparently high levels of toxins that were released near the station, they really didn't have much of a chance from the beginning, Webster said.
You confirmed that they died from cyanide poisoning? Dirk asked.
Yes. How did you know? That information hasn't been made public.
We recovered a dead sea lion from the island, which a CDC team in Seattle examined after we returned. They found that it had been killed by cyanide inhalation.
That is consistent with the autopsy reports of the two Coast Guard men.
Have you uncovered any information on the boat that fired at us and presumably released the cyanide?
After an uncomfortable pause, Webster replied, "No additional information has been obtained."
Unfortunately, the description provided matches for 1,000 other fishing boats of its kind.
It is not believed to have been a local vessel, and we are now working with the Japanese authorities to investigate leads in their country.
So you believe there is a Japanese connection? Any ideas on why someone would launch a chemical attack on a remote weather station in the Aleutians?
Mr. Pitt, Yost interrupted.
Did you know the men who tried to kill you in Seattle?
Never saw them before.
They appeared to be semi-professionals, more than just a pair of hired street hoods.
Webster opened a file on the table before him and slid over a crinkled photograph in the form of a small postcard.
Dirk silently looked at the black-and-white image of a hardened Japanese woman of 50 who glared violently into the camera lens.
An homage card of Fusako Shigenobu, former revolutionary leader of the JRA, Webster continued. Found it in the wallet of one of your would-be assassins after we fished them out of the Sound.
What's the JRA? Dirk asked.
The Japanese Red Army. An international terrorist cell that dates to the 1970s. Believed to have been broken up with the arrest of Shigenobu in 2000, they appear to have staged a deadly resurgence in activity.
I've read that the prolonged weakness in Japan's economy has spawned renewed interest in fringe cults by the Japanese youth, Gunn added.
The JRA has attracted more than a few bored youths. They have claimed responsibility for the assassinations of our ambassador to Japan and deputy chief of mission, as well as the explosion at the Semcon plant in Shiba. These were all very professional hits. The public outrage, as you are no doubt aware, is straining our relations with Tokyo. We suspect the JRA may have been behind the cyanide attack on Yonaska as a prelude to a more deadly strike in a major urban area, Yost added.
And also behind the smallpox infection of the Yonaska scientist Irv Fowler, Dirk stated.
We have not established that link, Webster countered. Our analysts suspect that the scientist may have contracted the disease in Unalaska from a local Aleut. Japanese authorities do not believe the JRA is sophisticated enough to obtain and disperse the smallpox virus.
I might think otherwise, Dirk cautioned.
Mr. Pitt, we are not here to gather your conspiracy theories, Yost remarked in a belittling tone. We are just interested in learning what two JRA agents were doing in the country and why they tried to kill a Numa diver.
That's Special Projects Director, Dirk replied as he hoisted the duffel bag up onto the conference table. Then giving it a strong shove, he pushed the bag across the table in the direction of Yost. The arrogant Transportation Security Director scrambled to hoist a cup of coffee out of the way before the bag slid up against his chest.
Your answer is in there, Dirk stated brusquely.
Webster stood and unzipped the bag as Yost and Gunn looked on intently. Carefully wrapped in foam padding was a large section of the bomb canister that Dirk had recovered from the I-403. The silver porcelain casing was split open, revealing a segmented interior with several empty compartments positioned beneath a small nose-tip component.
What is it? Gunn asked.
A 60-year-old dirty bomb, Dirk replied. He then retold the story of the World War II attack on Fort Stevens, his discovery of the submarine, and the retrieval of the bomb canister.
An ingenious weapon, Dirk continued. I had the epidemiology lab in Washington test for trace elements to see what was armed in the payload section.
It's made of porcelain, Webster noted. Used to protect biological agents.
The nose cone had a simple, timed explosive designed to detonate at a pre-specified altitude to disperse the main payload armament. As you can see, it would have been a pretty small charge, enough to shatter the porcelain casing but not damage the payload with undue heat or pressure. Dirk pointed to the interior payload compartments, which were cigar-shaped and stretched nearly to the tail fins.
It's not clear whether the payload agents were mixed together during flight or upon detonation, but the bomb could obviously carry multiple compounds. The contents might be one or more biological agents with a booster, or a combination of biological or chemical agents. The CDC lab was only able to find a trace chemical agent in one of the compartments on this particular bomb.
Cyanide? Gunn asked.
None other, Dirk replied.
But why utilize more than one payload? Webster queried.
To ensure a specific kill zone and, perhaps, divert attention. Let's say cyanide was combined with a biological agent. The cyanide gas would have a high lethality in a concentrated area only, whereas the biological agent would create gradual problems over a larger region.
Cyanide gas also dissipates quickly, so attack survivors would re-enter the drop zone unaware of a secondary danger. But that's just speculation. It's possible the canister design was for a different intent, to strike with a mixture of several chemical agents or biological agents that would produce a higher lethality in combination. So what additional agents were on this bomb? Gunn asked. Dirk shook his head slowly. That we don't know. The lab technicians were unable to detect any remaining trace elements from the other compartments. We know that the reason for using porcelain was to house biological agents, but the Japanese experimented with all kinds of organisms, so it could be anything from bubonic plague to yellow fever. Or smallpox, Gunn asked. Or smallpox, Dirk confirmed. Yost's face glowed beet red. This is a preposterous fantasy, he grumbled. The history lesson is interesting, but irrelevant. A modern terrorist group salvaging weapons off a World War II submarine? A nice story, but how are your biological viruses going to survive under the sea for 60 years, Mr. Pitt? We know the Japanese Red Army. It's a small, tight-knit organization with limited sophistication. Political assassination and planted explosives are within their means. Deep-sea salvage and microbiology are not. I have to agree with Rob, Webster added in a muted tone. Although the cyanide canister is an interesting coincidence with the UNASCA attack, the fact is that cyanide is a compound readily obtainable from many sources. You've admitted that there is no traceable evidence supporting the smallpox source, and we don't know for sure if the missing bomb canister on the sub was lost somewhere else on the vessel or was even loaded on board in the first place. Dirk reached over to the duffel bag and unzipped a side pocket, pulling out the still-blinking digital timer he'd found in the torpedo room. Maybe you can at least find out where this came from, he said, handing it to Webster. Could have been left behind by a sport diver, Yost noted. A sport diver with a possessive disposition, apparently, Dirk remarked dryly. I've been shot at twice now. I don't know who these characters are, but they take their game seriously. I assure you we have a full investigation underway, Webster stated. I'll have our lab in Quantico reanalyze the bomb casing and take a look at the timer. We will find the perpetrators who caused the death of the two Coast Guardsmen. The words were firm, but the hollow tone in his voice revealed his lack of confidence in the outcome. We can offer a safe house for you, Mr. Pitt, until we have made an apprehension, he added. No thanks. If these people are who you say they are, then I should have nothing more to fear. After all, how many JRA operatives can they have in the country? Dirk asked with a penetrating glare. Webster and Yost looked at each other in unknowing silence. Gunn jumped in diplomatically. We appreciate your investigation into the loss of our helicopter, he said, gently ushering the men to the door. Please keep us advised as to any new developments, and of course, Numa will be happy to assist in any way we can. After they left the room, Dirk sat silently shaking his head. They've hushed up the UNASCA incident because they're getting so much flack for the unsolved assassinations in Japan, Gunn said. Homeland Security and the FBI are stymied and are relying on the Japanese authorities to make a break in the case. The last thing they want to admit on top of that is that the smallpox case was part of the attack, with just one victim and no terrorists. The evidence may be weak, but there is no reason to foolishly ignore an attack on our own soil, Dirk stated. I'll speak to the Admiral about it. The director of the FBI is an old tennis partner of his. He'll make sure it doesn't get brushed under the carpet. They were interrupted by a knock on the door, followed by the lean face of Jaeger poking in. Sorry to intrude. Dirk, I have something for you. Come in, Hiram. Rudy and I were just plotting the overthrow of the government. Was Max able to access the National Archives' secure records? Does McDonald's have golden arches? Jaeger replied, feigning insult. Gunn gave Dirk a sideways glance, then shook his head in amusement.
If you guys get caught on a security breach, do me a favor and blame it on your father, will you?
Dirk laughed.
Sure, Rudy. What did you find, Hiram?
The Naval Ministry records were somewhat limited. It's a shame that most all of the original documents were returned to the Japanese government in the 50s. The available records in the archives are, of course, written in Japanese, using a variety of dialects, so I had to set up several translation programs before I could initiate a scan. Yeager paused and poured himself a cup of coffee from a large silver urn before continuing. As it is, you are in luck. I found a log of operations orders from the Japanese 6th Fleet covering the last 6 months of 1944.
Including the I-403? Dirk asked.
Yep. Its mission of December 1944 evidently had high importance. It was approved by the fleet admiral himself. The actual sailing order was short and sweet.
Yeager pulled a sheet of paper from a thin folder and read aloud.
Proceed northerly route to Pacific West Coast, refueling Amchitka, Morioka. Initiate aerial strike with Makaze ordnance earliest practicable. Primary target, Tacoma, Seattle, Vancouver, Victoria. Alternate target, Alameda, Oakland, San Francisco. With the Emperor's blessing.
That's a pretty ambitious target list for just two planes, Gunn remarked.
Think about it, though, Dirk said. The cities are concentrated enough all to be reached on a single flyover. Two or three biological bombs per city would wreak deadly havoc, if that's in fact what they were.
Hiram, you said the ordnance was referred to as Makaze.
St. Julian Perlmutter found mention of the same term. Any information on what they were?
I was curious about that myself, Yeager replied. I found that the literal translation was evil wind or black wind. But there was no additional information in the official naval records.
Yeager paused and sat back in his chair with a knowing look.
Well, did you find anything else? Gunn finally goaded.
It was Max, actually, Yeager replied proudly. After exhausting the National Archives data, I had her search the public databases in the U.S. and Japan. In a Japanese genealogy database, she hit pay dirt, locating an obscure diary from a sailor who served aboard the I-403 during the war. Holding a printout up to his face, he continued,
Mechanic First Class Hiroshi Sakura, Imperial Navy Air Corps, was a lucky devil. He came down with appendicitis while the sub was crossing the Pacific on its fateful voyage in December of 1944 and was transferred off the boat and onto the refueling ship in the Aleutian Islands. All his shipmates, of course, went on to perish when the sub was sunk off Washington State.
And he made mention of the I-403's mission? Dirk asked.
In vivid detail. It turns out that the young Mr. Sakura, in addition to his aircraft mechanic duties, was also in charge of aerial ordnance for the submarine's airplanes. He wrote that before they left port on their final voyage, an army officer named Tanaka brought aboard an unusual type of aerial bomb that was to be used on the mission. The shipboard morale became very high, he added, when the crew learned they were to make an attack on the United States. But there was much mystery and speculation about the unknown weapon.
Did he identify what it was? Gunn pressed.
He tried to, but working with the fellow Tanaka was difficult. A gloomy, overbearing, obstinate taskmaster, he wrote about the officer. Typical Army-Navy rivalry, I suppose. Plus, the submariners didn't like his being a last-minute addition to the sailing crew. At any rate, he pressed Tanaka for information, but to no avail. Finally, just before he fell ill and was transferred off the sub in the Aleutians, he wriggled the information out of one of the pilots. The pilot, so the story goes, shared some sake with Tanaka and was able to pry the secret payload out of him. It was smallpox.
Good God! So it's true, Gunn exclaimed.
Apparently so.
He wrote that the payload was a freeze-dried virus, which was to be detonated and dispersed at altitude above the most concentrated population points of each city. Within 2 weeks, an outbreak of smallpox was expected all along the West Coast. With a 30% mortality rate, the deaths would have been staggering. The Japanese figured the resulting panic would allow them to negotiate a peace settlement on their terms. The threat of more smallpox bombs on our home soil might very well have changed the resolve of many people to finish the war, Gunn speculated. An uneasiness crept over the room as the three considered how history may have played out differently had the I-403 successfully completed its mission. Their thoughts then turned to the possibility of a more current threat. You mentioned that the virus was freeze-dried. So they must have had the ability to store the virus for long periods and then rejuvenate it, Dirk commented. Necessary for a long sea voyage, Jaeger added. According to Max, the Japanese had difficulty in keeping the viruses alive in their munitions for any length of time. They ultimately perfected a way of freeze-drying the virus for easier handling and longer storage until the need for activation when deployed. Insert a little H2O and you're in business. So the virus could still be a viable danger, even after 60 years at the bottom of the sea, Gunn remarked. I guess that answers Yost's question. There's no reason the smallpox wouldn't survive in freeze-dried form if the canisters hadn't cracked during sinking. Since they're made of porcelain, the canisters could survive intact for centuries underwater, Dirk said. Might also explain the various interior segments to the bomb. A compartment with water was needed to rejuvenate the virus. Perhaps it was more fortunate than we know that all but one of the canisters were demolished on the I-403, Gunn remarked. That still leaves one canister unaccounted for, Dirk replied. Yes, as well as the other mission ordnance, Jaeger added. Dirk and Gunn looked at each other. What other mission? Gunn asked incredulously. The I-411. Jaeger felt their eyes boring right through him. Didn't you know? He asked. There was a second submarine, the I-411. It, too, was armed with the Mikaze ordnance and was sent to attack the eastern seaboard of the United States, Jaeger said quietly, realizing he had just dropped a bomb of his own.